From the Radio Ranch in the heart of Liberty, Texas, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Wednesday, October 2nd, 2024. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
You're yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth. The kid with the patriotic red, white, and blue eyes, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things started officially with
the Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says here, obstacles are those frightful things you see when you take your eyes off the goal. What are these strange things you speak of called goals?
Get used to disappointment.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the big blogcast here.
Twisted history.
That's it.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Don't say.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Okay.
You might be quizzed.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was sworn in as the first African-American justice of the United States Supreme Court. And he went on to serve for almost forever. At the School of Law, Texas Southern University is named after him, too. And it was on this day in 1980, Michael Myers became the first member of either chamber of commerce to be expelled since the Civil War. After his expulsion, he went on to further notoriety as the central character in the Halloween films.
He did not.
Hey, that's what I heard.
Round up the usual suspects.
If you saw last night's debate, you saw what I saw, right? I was amazed at how cordial the two J.D. Vance and Tim Walz were toward each other. It was a very civilized debate. And there was not as much acrimony in there as I thought there would be. However, there was one point where the moderators, you know, it's really funny. I liked J.D. Vance and Tim Walz more than I liked the moderators. The two moderators, what's their names, from CBS, tried to fact check J.D. Vance, but he stopped them in their tracks and fact checked them instead. And they didn't like it. And they muted his mic. And it was really pretty disgusting for network television, but here it is.
Temporary protected status.
Well, Margaret, but
thank you, Senator. We have so much to get to.
Margaret, I think it's important
because we're going to turn out of the economy. Thank you,
Margaret. The rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check, and since you're fact checking me, I think it's important to say what's actually going on. So there's an application called the CBP One app, where you can go on as an illegal migrant, apply for asylum or apply for parole, and be granted legal status at the wave of a Kamala Harris open border wand. That is not a person coming in, applying for a green card and waiting for 10 years.
Thank you, Senator. That is the facilitation
of illegal immigration, Margaret, by
Thank
our
you,
own
Thank you, Senator, for
leadership.
Describing the legal process. We have so much to get to, Senator.
Those laws have been on the books since 1990.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The CBP One app has not been on the books since 1990.
There's where they cut off his mic.
Gentlemen, the audience can't hear you because your mics are cut. We have so much we want to get to. Thank you for explaining the legal process.
Jeez. Yeah, disgusting, disgusting. But then again, I expected something like that from the network because we are, after all, dealing with the mainstream media, the lamestream media. And if you're ever looking for fairness toward conservatives from the mainstream media, you are swimming upstream, my friend. So, as far as the overall debate went last night, I think it was the best one I've seen in a long darn time. The acrimony was at an all-time low. The two men seemed to be pretty cordial toward each other. And Tim Walz, he was exactly what I expected him to be. Somewhat convincing and yet lying through his teeth on a lot of things. But I will say this. He was better than I thought he would be. But as far as who won the debate last night, hands down, J.D. Vance. He was obviously better prepared and much more knowledgeable. And isn't that what we wanted? Now that the excitement of the debate has died down a little bit, thought you might like to know that the House Oversight Committee, that's the one where Jim Jordan is at the big desk, has tossed a subpoena at the Department of Homeland Security. Now, it's not because of something the DHS has done or hasn't done necessarily, but here's what's interesting. Truth has a way of getting out. And at this time, it's all thanks to some gossip in a group chat drama. Apparently, DHS employees couldn't keep quiet about Tim Walz's connections with China. And according to whistleblowers, this chat group has become the focus of an investigation. Somebody, we're not saying who, because we don't know, but somebody spilled the beans, and it won't be long before this is brought into the light. Especially with the track record that Jim Jordan has. Somebody by the name of Ian Yeager tweeted, "Breaking, House Oversight Committee has just announced that a whistleblower has informed U.S. intelligence that there are verified links between the Chinese Communist Party and vice presidential candidate Tim Walz." Okay, that tweet went out on Monday. So the House Oversight Committee subpoenaed the DHS on Monday following whistleblower allegations about an internal employee group chat that was busy about the task of discussing serious concerns about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz's China ties, some of which have been documented in classified files. See, that's when it starts to get really serious. Now, Oversight Panel Chairman James Comer revealed the internal debate on the longstanding connection. My bad, I said Jim Jordan, but that's not the committee that Jordan is in charge of, okay? It's James Comer, who is also, just like Jordan, very good, very thorough, very knowledgeable. So Comer revealed the internal debate on and apparently what's being described as, let's put it that way, it's being described as a longstanding connection between Walz and Chinese Communist Party officials. So this was in the Monday letter to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, which bothers me because Mayorkas, as you know, lies through his teeth. Every time his mouth moves, he's lying. But this is all according to a copy of the letter obtained by the New York Post. Was it the New York Post? Well, they're not saying here. Anyhow, Comer wrote, "Specifically through whistleblower disclosures, the committee has learned of a non-classified Microsoft Teams group." This would be a group chat among DHS employees titled NSTNFT Biweekly Sync that contains information about Governor Walz that's relevant to the committee's investigation. Comer demanded all records on the internal group chat between July 1st and the present, as well as any intelligence information reports or regional intelligence notes between November 2023 and the present. So, let's see here. Somebody, Tim Walz, from all indications, really loves China. Now, how that love started is something I'd like to know. I don't know how you go about finding that out without doing a raft of interviews that I can't afford the travel to do. But, you know, thank God for the internet. We'll try to find out what it is that started this big love affair between Tim Walz and China. But according to Dustin Grage, in a tweet, Mr. Grage said, "Tim Walz has visited China a lot. He speaks Chinese and has visited the country 30 plus times." And then he enclosed a clip in this tweet, a video clip, where Tim Walz is talking about how friendly he is with China. And here's an interesting lie that Walz made about being in China during the Tiananmen Square massacre. Walz is on record in Congress as being present in Hong Kong during the massacre, which he wasn't, according to a conflicting report. Again, dug up by this fellow, Dustin Grage. And he says, "To make matters worse for Walz, he and his wife chose the fifth anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre because he wanted to have a date he'll always remember. Awfully bad look to choose a date you would never forget and lie about your whereabouts during that time." Yeah. So one would be justified in getting the feeling that Tim Walz wouldn't be a good choice as any type of leader in our country. He appears to bleed red. And of course, I mean red as in communist red. In another tweet, Dustin Grage, I'd like to find out more about him, says Tim Walz's connections to the radical Chinese Communist Party continue. Here I have a recently recovered photo of Commissioner Ida Rukavina's home. She is the Walz appointee to the IRRRB, which oversees the largest untapped copper nickel reserve in the world. Okay, so the photo is of the interior of this Ida Rukavina's home, and she's got a picture of Che Guevara and Mao Zedong on her study walls. Yeah. I mean, here again, it goes back to Walt Kelly in his comic strip. And this was back in the late 1960s when he wrote, "We have met the enemy and he is us." A proposed drilling ban in Colorado has ignited what I would call a fierce national debate. Yeah, it's gone national already. And it highlights the tension between environmental protection and energy independence. Oh, God, please get Donald Trump back into the White House. See, earlier this year, Democratic lawmakers introduced two significant bills aiming to curb new oil and gas permits starting in 2028 and to implement a seasonal moratorium on oil production for 5 months each year. Now, you don't need to be a genius in politics or economics to understand that if passed, this would make Colorado the first major oil-producing state to implement these kinds of strict regulations, setting a precedent that could influence national policies. That's the thing that bothers me. I mean, if Colorado wants to shut things down, fine, go for it. We've still got Texas. We've got Pennsylvania. But, you know, if there's the threat that this could start some kind of a fever to go nationwide, well, then we're screwed. I mean, I find it rather interesting that I could grow up in the 1950s, 60s, go through the 1970s were a little iffy because we had the oil embargoes, two of them, major ones. The 70s were a rough time to try to survive, especially when you were in your 20s and 30s trying to make your way and supporting a family. And you had all these environ Nazis out there trying to shut down fossil fuels. You know, kind of like what we're going through right now. I mean, this is akin where we are right now with our economy and our political climate. This is where we were under Jimmy Carter, who, by the way, just turned 100 yesterday. Happy birthday, Jimmy. I'm glad you're no longer president. But, you know, this is a situation we need to look at very seriously. Now, this push for tighter oil and gas regs comes amid these increasing concerns over environmental impacts, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't be concerned about it, but it's like everything else the government does and everything else the left does, they go so far overboard. Now, the big concern here, and I will concede, rightfully so, air pollution and public health issues stemming from oil production. Okay, in Colorado, which ranks fourth, believe it or not, ranks fourth in the country in oil output, has seen crude production rise pretty dramatically in recent years, and this is thanks to advancements in fracking and horizontal drilling technologies. However, these developments have also sparked a lot of widespread public backlash, especially as drilling operations expand into more populated areas. So supporters of the ban are arguing that it's a necessary step in reducing pollution and tackling the climate crisis. Well, there's no climate crisis going on that can be blamed on human activity, but you won't convince the environ-Nazis of that. I mean, this has been a weird year for weather, but have you been watching what's been going on with the sun this year? We've had some very large, unusually large solar flares. And if you think that stopping drilling in a given area here in the United States is going to prevent solar flares, I'm sorry, you have absolutely no grasp of the situation. So, Colorado's Front Range region, where oil production is pretty much concentrated, has been flagged by the EPA for dangerously high ozone levels, with oil and gas operations contributing significantly to the problem, in their words. So you've got your advocates believing that phasing out new drilling permits is crucial to improving air quality and protecting vulnerable communities. But far be it from them to actually hypothesize that maybe they should take a look at curbing the emissions that are generated in the process of drilling. Anybody think about that? No. Let's just shut down drilling. Now, despite strong support from environmental groups, the proposed legislation is, believe it or not, facing stiff opposition from the oil industry and Republican lawmakers, and they still have some Republican lawmakers left in Colorado. I don't know if they have enough, but they still have some, and that's a step in the right direction. You know, Colorado used to be a red state, but they turned blue about 10, 15 years ago, something like that. So critics are warning that a ban like this, the one that they're proposing, would of course have severe economic consequences, especially for Colorado, where oil and gas operations contribute more than $48 billion annually and support over 300,000 jobs. Now, Dan Haley, who's the CEO of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, pointed out that similar restrictions in other states have failed to materialize due to the economic risks involved. Hopefully that will be the case in Colorado. And he cautioned that Colorado's energy sector, which, by the way, is already weakened by previous regulations, could shrink further if the ban does, in fact, go into effect. Now, the battle over oil and gas production in Colorado is not new. 2019, the state passed legislation giving local governments more power to regulate the industry and requiring the Colorado Energy and Carbon Management Commission to address the cumulative impacts of drilling. But several lawmakers feel that these rules haven't gone far enough, accusing regulators of prioritizing industry interests over public health. And that may very well be the case, okay? I'm just trying to look at this objectively. That may very well be the case. So in response, state legislators have been pushing for even stricter measures, culminating in the current proposed ban. Now, the implications of Colorado's legislative fight go far beyond its borders. You've got other Democrat-led states like New Mexico and California have also considered similar measures, though with limited success, thank God. I mean, you do understand, don't you, the effect this will have on a national basis for our economy. You think brownouts are bad now, you're going to have blackouts for extended periods and probably during the most uncomfortable times of the year, which would be summer and winter. Now, New Mexico, which is the nation's second largest oil producer, believe it or not, has struggled to pass new restrictions on oil production despite their Democrat majority, which is reassuring. Meanwhile, California's efforts to limit drilling near homes and schools have faced significant hurdles. And as Colorado's lawmakers are preparing for what's expected to be a protracted legislative battle, oh, you can bet it will be. Both sides of the debate are gearing up for high-stakes showdowns. Environmental groups are determined to push the legislation through because they're framing it as a moral obligation to protect future generations. In any other case, they don't give a damn about future generations, i.e., look at the abortion issue. But on the other hand, industry advocates are warning of the economic fallout and the potential for energy shortages if oil production is curtailed too drastically. We've seen that before, haven't we? So with the 2028 deadline for new oil permits looming there in Colorado, their decision could mark a turning point in the national debate over the future of fossil fuels and the balance between economic growth and environmental sustainability. But the point that has to be made here, while they hash this out, the point that needs to be made here is we are teetering on the edge of a cliff that would have the entire nation falling into energy deficits, the likes of which we have never, never seen before. And believe me, my friend, you don't want to go there. Conservative commentator, I guess you would call her now. She's at a podcast, very popular podcast on Sirius XM. Megyn Kelly, you remember her from the Fox News Channel. Well, this is so beautiful. She reminded everyone that the lawfare against Donald Trump is utter nonsense. Now, I need to emphasize here that Kelly is a former lawyer, and she was able to speak to the absurdity of going after Trump, like few others could, during her appearance on the All In podcast. Now, this was from the All In Summit in Los Angeles. It took place back in early September, between the 8th and the 10th. Now, her full appearance can be found on the internet. It's interesting, but I've got about almost three and a half minutes worth of material from her that I'm going to play for you. That's really the meat of what took place there. And it's the moment that sparked a tremendous reaction from the crowd when the summit's host, a fellow by the name of Jason Calacanis, it's C-A-L-A-N-I-S. C-A-L-A-C-A-N-I-S. Okay, sorry about that. So I take that to, I'm going to interpret that as Calacanis if I'm putting the accent on the right syllable. Well, anyhow, this guy Jason asked Kelly about Trump. And the first minute of the clip is actually pretty bad for Calacanis, because he tried to misrepresent the cases against Trump. Now, he was possibly just confusing legal jargon, if I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. But to no avail, because Kelly corrected him in a way that almost deflated any moment he had in the dialogue. You are so going to love this. And regardless, Kelly took the chance to tell the panel and the audience just why everything being brought against Trump is so nonsensical.
I think Trump on appeal will win. There are so many holes in that case, so I don't think Trump will ever do one single day in jail.
So, Megyn, if we look at the five cases, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, let's assume all five of them go to trial. He's guilty of three so far.
Wait, what do you mean he's guilty of three so far?
Well, he's been convicted of three, sorry.
What do you mean? No, he hasn't.
I love this.
E. Jean Carroll was guilty.
That was not a conviction. That was a civil case.
Okay, well, yes, so that's what I'm talking about. So that
okay,
one
but there's a big difference.
It's still he was convicted. He was guilty of that. He got a settlement. In the Trump Organization, they're guilty there.
That,
okay,
again, was still civil, liable.
Yes, of course. But these are the cases we're talking about. And in the third one...
you know she's a lawyer, right?
Yeah, of course. And in the third one... I'm just talking about the five cases. Yes, some are civil, obviously, and some are not. Some are criminal. But if we look
you
at all five
cases... You said three convictions. Now you're walking it back.
I'm not walking it back. There's
Get
three in which he was...
You should walk it back.
Okay, I'm
guys,
so glad Megyn is here
to dispel
this.
Of the five, three of them,
this.
He's either guilty or...
He got a bad result.
Yeah, got a bad result. There are two more. If he is found guilty of those two more, Megyn, and five of five, he had a bad result. Way to frame it. Will you chalk all five up in your mind to five different jurisdictions, five different prosecutors, five different juries and or judges, all conspiring to get him?
100%.
Okay.
Yes.
That's all I wanted to hear your answer to. Five different jurisdictions.
Yeah.
You think it's all lawfare.
I mean, E. Jean Carroll, they changed the law so that she could bring a civil lawsuit against him, and she did. New York went 87% for Joe Biden. That fix was in right from the start. The fraud trial that Letitia James brought against him has never been brought. There's no victims. The banks who were involved said, we didn't lose a penny. What are we doing here? We weren't damaged. Yep. Nobody was complaining except Tish James, who ran for office saying, I will get him. Then you have Alvin Bragg, who's a George Soros-funded prosecutor who doesn't like to prosecute any crime crime in New York City, where I lived for 17 years, except if your name is Donald Trump. Let's go down to Georgia, where Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade couldn't keep their libidos in check long enough to actually bring this case against Donald Trump. It's a repeat of what was happening in January 6th up in the case with Judge Chutkan, who loathes Trump and has sentenced almost every J6 defendant to way more jail time than their counterparts would get. Those are falling apart because of presidential immunity, which was handed down by the Supreme Court, who said you cannot bring a criminal case against a sitting president for any official act. Those cases are, have been gutted. Also, a Supreme Court ruling saying the same on January 6th defendants in general. And that leaves us with Florida and the documents. And Trump has torn that apart because Jack Smith wasn't properly appointed and isn't the right counsel. But there are other issues. They haven't even gotten to presidential immunity there. And so that one's going nowhere as well. And by the way, they're going to appeal it up to the 11th Circuit. She just threw it out. The 11th Circuit is conservative. And thank God, so is the current Supreme Court. They're not going to tolerate that nonsense.
Let me ask you about...
I think Jay Cal just lost his right to ever bring up lawfare again.
And during this summit, she even brought up the effort to prosecute those who were present on January 6th. And you can listen to Kelly dismantle each case one by one as she articulates the problems. So all in all, it isn't just those of us who lack legal training that sense something is really amiss, something conspiratorial is amiss with the lawfare against Trump. And of course, it's easy to chalk up criticism of the system against Trump to fanatical MAGA Republicans who would support him through thick and thin. There are other elements at play, though. So Megyn Kelly's not alone, as others like legal scholar Jonathan Turley. He's another one. Jonathan Turley is a self-professed Democrat, but it's amazing how he comes to the defense of Donald Trump. And they've all been outspoken. The lawfare against Trump proves how widespread the opposition to his reelection prospects is. And I believe very firmly that this is all the work of the deep state, because the deep state knows while he may not succeed, he's going to give it a great effort to dispose of the deep state. Let's head on over to the Comedy Corner with Dennis Regan.
You know, sometimes the teachers would say this. They'd say, there's no such thing as a stupid question. I liked it when they said that. You know what I would do when they said that? I would raise my hand. Yes, Mrs. Baxter, is it possible for a 12-year-old boy to get pregnant from reading comic books? No? No? Oh, okay, I got some misinformation from my older brother. College was different, though. And professors, the college professors, they never said there was no such thing as a stupid question. You know why? Because they knew better than that. You don't get to be a college professor and still hold the belief there's no such thing as a stupid question, you know? So in college, I needed a different strategy, a different tactic, because I didn't want to study or do the assignments or anything like that. So I'd come up with smart questions that would make me sound smart to the teachers, you know, so when they were given the grades, they might think, hey. So I'd be like, yes, professor, after perusing the copious reading assignments, which you ungrudgingly designate as compulsory, it has become abundantly clear to me that the incipient, and might I say pandemic rise of quantitative easing in the post-holographic arena spawns a situation and, in fact, a conundrum in which the widespread growth of existential and even dystopian paradigms will threaten to dominate the landscape for the foreseeable future. Now, having said that, how would you therefore postulate a quid pro quo complexification from a nihilistic standpoint? And being broadly contemporaneous, would that postulation even be germane to the philosophical dogma of the period? And secondly, because this is really a two-part question. Didn't like math. Math was my least favorite subject. You like school? You're in school? You're in school now? What's your name?
Chanel.
Chanel? What are you studying?
Nursing.
Nursing? Yeah. I studied doctoring. What do they call it, medicine? It was a lot. It's a lot. I dropped out after 2 years of high school. No, I didn't like being a doctor. I was a doctor for one day. Yeah, everybody complains about everything, and I just like, I can't do this.
Have a wonderful Wednesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And you be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.